From Brennan to the Boca Chiel, from Lummi to La Push, and from the lordly Sawduck to lovely Duckabush. From Samish to Sammamish, Suquamish to Quilicene, the climate is so friendly, it's a land that's evergreen.
Hello, and welcome to the History of the Evergreen State podcast. I'm your host and producer, John C., and thank you for joining me today for episode 143, Territorial and State Governor Elisha P. Ferry. Elisha Pear Ferry was the youngest child of Peter Pear Ferry and Ann Lloyd Jones Ferry, both of whom had emigrated to the United States from France and England, respectively. Elisha was born on the 9th of August, 1825, in Monroe, Michigan. Before moving to the United States in the early 1800s, Peter Ferry, whose birth name was Pierre and who served as a colonel in the French army, was known to have been a member of Napoleon's cavalry. Peter and Anne Ferry got married in New York in 1809, but by the time their first son was born 2 years later, the couple had moved to Connecticut where they were residing. By the year 1816, the Ferry family had relocated to the region around Sandusky Bay on Lake Erie in northern Ohio, which is also where Peter Ferry began his career as the first collector of customs for the port of Sandusky. In the year 1822, they made the move to Monroe. Elisha, along with at least some of his other siblings, was given the same middle name as his father. It was clear that Elisha took great pride in the family name, as he intended to carry on the custom with his own offspring. Elisha Ferry spent his childhood and his school years in Monroe, where his father held the positions of school teacher, Monroe County Treasurer, and Justice of the Peace. Ferry began his legal education in his hometown and then continued it in Fort Wayne, Indiana. At the age of 20, he was admitted to the bar in 1845, and the following year he moved to Waukegan, Illinois, where he lived and worked as a lawyer for the next 20 years. Ferry tied the knot with Sarah Brown Kellogg in 1849. They were blessed with 5 children, all of whom reached adulthood: Elizabeth, Lizzie, James, Lincoln, Julia, and Pierre. Ferry began to engage in political activity in addition to his work as an attorney. In the presidential elections of 1852 and 1856, he was a presidential elector, and in 1859, he was chosen as the first mayor of Waukegan. He served as a bank commissioner for the state of Illinois during the years 1861 through 1863. Ferry was promoted to the rank of colonel in the Union Army not long after the conflict between the North and South broke out in 1861. Ferry's participation in the Civil War turned out to be a defining moment in both his professional and his personal life. During his time as an assistant adjutant general on the staff of Illinois Governor Richard Yates Sr., he was responsible for the organization, equipping, and forwarding many Illinois regiments to the field. It was during this time that he became friends with General Ulysses Grant. Ferry was appointed Surveyor General of the rapidly expanding Washington Territory in 1869, not long after Grant was elected president. Grant, who had earlier in his career served in Washington Territory, made the appointment shortly after his election. Because of this, Ferry moved to Washington, where he would eventually hold the most powerful post in the land and spend the remainder of his life. In July of 1869, Ferry moved his family from Waukegan to Olympia, which was then the capital of Washington Territory and would eventually become the capital of the state of Washington. There, he began his duties as Surveyor General. The Donation Land Claim Act of 1850 was the legislation that led to the establishment of the Office of Surveyor General. This act was passed in an effort to encourage American families to relocate to what was then known as Oregon Territory by providing free land grants of up to 640 acres to each family that did so. The Surveyor General was in charge of organizing and supervising the land surveys that were necessary to find and document the settlers' land claims. In 1853, when the Washington Territory was split off from the state of Oregon, the new territory received its own office for the Surveyor General. Surveyors working for the Surveyor General put out survey lines, eventually forming a grid across the state of Washington of square townships, each 6 miles on a side and consisting of 36 1-square-mile, 640-acre sections, on which claims might be located. Surveying the land along the lines of transcontinental railroads being built into the Northwest, which Congress awarded to the railroads as an incentive to build, was another function that had been added to the staff of the Surveyor General by the time Ferry assumed office. Ferry was a lawyer and not a surveyor. There is no evidence to suggest that he personally engaged in the survey work that was being done. Ferry was recognized as a political figure from the start, and he dove headfirst into the political infighting that was going on in the territorial capital as soon as he was appointed to the job, which was a political patronage position after all. Berry was a Republican, just like his patron President Grant. Even though the majority of authorities in Washington Territory at the time were anti-slavery, that did not stop intense rivalries from breaking out between them. Berry made a deal with Seleucus Garfield to become his ally. Garfield, who was considered to be one of the most talented orators of his time, started his political career in Washington as a Democrat. However, he spent the years of the Civil War in British Columbia, and upon his return to Washington Territory, he switched his allegiance to the Republicans. One historian asserts that the subsequent two Republican candidates for congressional delegate, Seattle's founding father Arthur A. Denny and Alvin Flanders, both won election largely through the oratorical efforts of Seleucus Garfield. Garfield was given the position of Territory Surveyor General in 1865, and then, 4 years later, he attempted to acquire the position of delegate for himself. Garfield easily won the congressional seat that was opened up as a result of Grant's appointment of a governor for the Flanders territorial government. This also resulted in the opening of the Surveyor General post, which was filled by Ferry. During Flanders' 1 year in office, it was conceded by most observers of the territorial political scene that the recently arrived Ferry was the real power behind the scenes at the Capitol. Flanders was not known as a powerful executive, or even an effective one for that matter. After Flanders was replaced as territorial governor in January of 1870 by Edward S. Solomon, who was more capable and enthusiastic than many who temporarily inhabited the job, Ferry's power may have begun to diminish behind the scenes. But Ferry remained active in the capital's political and social scene, which in 1870 was centered on the anticipated arrival of the Northern Pacific Railway's transcontinental rail line, which was then under construction from Kalama on the Columbia River to Puget Sound. Ferry, in his capacity as Surveyor General, played a formal part in the construction of the Transcontinental Railway. Land surveys that were carried out under his direction would be used to locate the vast quantities of public land that Congress had promised the Rail Corporation on completion of construction as an incentive to build. As much as half of the total area, the odd-numbered square sections in a survey, was to be given to the Rail Corporation along a strip of land that was 40 miles on either side of the track. He, along with a large number of other territorial and local officeholders, aggressively pushed for the interests of the Northern Pacific in territorial politics and represented local concerns to the railway. Both of these roles were important to Ferry. The business and population expansion that would result from having a transcontinental rail terminus in their town was something that civic officials in the communities that surrounded Puget Sound were eager to have. People in Olympia, which was not only the state capital but also, at the time, the most populous town and most important commercial hub on the Sound, believed that it was only right that their city would be the terminal. On the other hand, their counterparts in Seattle, Port Townsend, Tacoma, Steilacoom, and other locales argued in favor of those particular places. Late in the year 1870, Ferry served as the head of a group of civic leaders from Olympia that had conversations with railroad officials about the terminus and a rail connection to Olympia. Ferry and others attempted to organize a local branch line from Olympia to the Northern Pacific Rails, but they were unsuccessful in their endeavors at the time. But the NP kept developing, and in December of 1871, railway authorities revealed plans to link to Puget Sound at Bud Inlet, which is the southern arm of the Sound on which Olympia is located. The news temporarily cheered Ferry and his fellow Olympia enthusiasts, and it sparked a boom that was short-lived. In 1871, the location of the terminal was not the only political issue that stirred up trouble in the region. In the fall of that year, the women's suffrage movement made a significant push for the right of women to vote. Abigail Scott Duniway, a suffragist from Oregon, and Susan B. Anthony, a national leader in the fight for women's suffrage, gave a lecture tour across Washington and Oregon that lasted for 2 months. It included a stop in Olympia, where Anthony gave a speech in favor of a forthcoming suffrage bill to the legislature. Ferry was a staunch opponent of equal suffrage at the time, despite the fact that many of the territorial officeholders were men and favored equal suffrage. He coordinated support for an anti-suffrage bill, which was ultimately approved by the Assembly. The resolution specifically denied women the right to vote until the Congress shall declare the same to be the supreme law of the land. Ferry's political connections helped him win the most prestigious award in territorial politics in the year 1872. Together with Garfield, he was successful in convincing President Grant to replace Governor Solomon with himself in April of that year. Garfield was gone from the political scene in no time, but it marked the beginning for Ferry of what would become the longest gubernatorial tenure in the history of the territory. In the latter part of that year, the protracted conflict that had been going on between the United States and Great Britain regarding ownership of the San Juan Islands was finally settled in favor of the U.S. Ferry made a trip to the islands in December for the purpose of reestablishing the civil authority in place of the divided military authority which had so long controlled there. At that point, it was very clear that the Northern Pacific was not going to make Olympia its transcontinental terminus, despite the fact that this was repeatedly assured to officials. The construction line took a swing to the northeast in order to proceed further up Puget Sound rather than continuing in a northerly direction toward the capital city. The city of Olympia's recent boom turned into a bust when it was bypassed, and in March of 1873, the officials of the city met to discuss how to respond to the situation. It appeared that building a branch line to the NP rails at Tenino, which is located 15 miles to the south, was the only way to secure the city's continued economic viability. However, at that point in time, they were unable to both organize and finance such an endeavor. Ferry's first full year in office was driven to a large extent by concerns over the endpoint as well as local links to the transcontinental line. In July of 1873, Northern Pacific made the announcement that Tacoma would be the city that would serve as the endpoint of the railroad. This news left civic officials in Seattle and other places that had hoped to serve as the terminus as devastated as those in Olympia. The residents of Seattle, much like those of Olympia, moved swiftly to begin building their very own rail line, which was at first envisioned as a connection between Seattle and Walla Walla, which is located well east of the mountains. The railroad fell into its own troubles not too long after it made the announcement about the endpoint. In September, the banking corporation known as Jay Cook & Company, which was responsible for providing financing for the Northern Pacific, went bankrupt. This event set off the countrywide panic of 1873 and left the Northern Pacific without the cash to finish its construction. Even though it was uncertain in October of 1873, when the territorial legislature gathered for the first time under Governor Ferry, whether the company would be successful in finishing the transcontinental line, legislators proceeded to adopt the territory's first legislation relating to railroads. These laws were the foundation for the railroad industry in the territory. The first mandated that businesses charge prices that were fair and prevented them from charging different clients different prices for the same service. Another law, which obviously intended to be helpful to the enterprises in which the people of Olympia, Seattle, and Walla Walla were then preparing to engage, encouraged the construction of new rail lines by exempting them from taxes until at least 15 miles of the line were completed and operating, and then taxing only the portion of the line that was actually being used. During that legislative session, which was the first one to take place after the conflict over the San Juan Islands had been resolved, Ferry lent his support to the citizens of the islands who were then a part of Whatcom County at the time in their campaign to establish San Juan County. In addition, Ferry engaged in a dispute with legislators concerning the selection of a new public printer. He desired that the coveted contract be given to Clarence Begley, who was the editor of the Daily Courier at the time. The Daily Courier was the only newspaper in the capital that supported Ferry and his side. The remainder, in keeping with the journalistic conventions of the time, made frequent personal attacks on Ferry and other opponents and derided them. A few years prior, when the Courier was first getting started, Ferry was the one who contributed the majority of the cash. In direct defiance of the wishes of the governor, the legislature selected Elisha Gunn, owner of the Transcript and one of Ferry's most outspoken editorial detractors, to serve as the official printer. In response, Ferry declared the legislative action to be invalid and announced that Begley had been chosen printer by the new territory secretary, Henry Struve. Struve was a Ferry supporter who had previously temporarily controlled the Courier and later served as mayor of Seattle. Begley was designated printer by Struve. Begley, who went on to write early histories of Seattle and King County, including sympathetic portraits of Ferry himself, enjoyed an all-time record tenure of 12 years as public printer in spite of concerns from legislators. In the beginning of November 1873, a number of Northern Pacific investors had put up money so that construction of the transcontinental line could proceed, but by the end of that same month, the money had run out and unpaid workers had barricaded the tracks to halt construction until they were paid their back salaries. The workers went to Ferry for assistance, and the governor, together with officials from the NP, tried to soothe them. However, at one point, he called out the militia to preserve order. The employees were eventually persuaded to resume building after receiving some cash, assurances that they would receive more, and script that could be used at corporate stores in Tacoma. On the 16th of December, 1873, the line was officially completed, and just a few weeks later, regular service got underway. With the Transcontinental Line in operation and legislative support in place for the development of further rail lines, residents of Olympia, led by Alicia and Sarah Ferry, rekindled their efforts to create a branch line connecting to the tracks in Tenino. Sarah Ferry encouraged prominent women of the city to handle their own cooking and housework so that male servants can focus on the building efforts. The governor was one of the leaders of a fundraising effort. Construction laborers were not the only people who contributed to the building of the branch line. Beginning in April of 1874, the city hosted a series of public workdays during which shops were closed and judges, lawyers, clergymen, and doctors worked alongside construction laborers. But the funding ran out after only 4 miles had been cleared, and it wasn't until 1877 that a new corporation created by Governor Ferry resumed construction. They eventually finished connecting Olympia to the main line in 1878, which was in the middle of Ferry's second term in office. Ferry was well-liked by the public despite the fact that he had his detractors. As a result, President Grant reappointed him to his position in 1876. Ferry entered into a contract with William Billings, who had served as the sheriff of Thurston County for a significant amount of time, to construct and administer the prison after the 1877 legislative session called for a penitentiary to keep territorial offenders. Prior to that time, territorial convicts had been kept in county jails. Shackled captives were forced to endure long days of hard labor at Washington's first penitentiary, which was located in what was originally called Seco, but was renamed Bacota in 1889 and was situated in southern Thurston County. The facility was infamous for its brutal conditions. It remained in use until 1887, when it was replaced by the Washington State Penitentiary, which is located in Walla Walla. There had been proposals for the territory to become a state since a long time before Ferry arrived in Washington. However, ballot propositions authorizing a convention to write a state constitution had continually failed to pass. Finally, in 1876, a bill was approved, and the following year, in 1878, a constitutional conference was conducted. It drafted a constitution, which was ultimately ratified by voters. But, despite the lobbying of Ferry and other territorial leaders, Congress did not pass legislation that enabled statehood at that time. Ferry worked hard during his tenure as territorial governor to improve the territory's financial situation. One of the ways he did this was by ensuring that the counties paid their fair amount of taxes to the territory on time. Many did not, which led to a delinquency of $13,000. Despite his exhortations, the deficit swelled to nearly $70,000 by the time of his last legislative session in 1879, when legislators ultimately embraced his proposal for legislation mandating payment. Ferry also campaigned for a Board of Equalization to assure fair tax assessments throughout the territory, a reform that was subsequently enacted after he pointed out major discrepancies between counties in how property was valued for tax assessments. During Ferry's tenure as governor, efforts to provide women the right to vote and serve on juries continued, but they were unsuccessful in the legislature. This was the case despite the fact that Ferry, despite his staunch opposition to women's suffrage prior, signaled that he would sign a suffrage measure if the legislation passed one. Finally, it was after Ferry had left office that the endeavor was successful. Despite the fact that the statute was declared unconstitutional by the highest court in the territory 4 years later, voting rights for women were not finally granted in Washington State until 1910, the experience of women taking an equal role in civic affairs changed a lot of minds. After Ferry's stint as governor ended in 1880, he and his family relocated to Seattle, where he joined what would later become the law firm of McNaught, Ferry, McNaught, and Mitchell. When he was offered the position of vice president at Puget Sound National Bank in 1887, he decided to leave the private practice. Ferry's popularity and performance as territorial governor encouraged the Republican Party, which was still powerful in the state at the time, to nominate him as its candidate to become the new state's first governor in 1889, when Congress eventually permitted Washington to become a state. On the 1st of October, voters, again all men, ratified the new state constitution that had been drafted in convention earlier in the year, and they elected the first state officials. Ferry won the election for the first elected governor of Washington State with relative ease, defeating Democrat Eugene Semple, who was one of his successors as governor of the territory. The day when statehood was officially recognized was the 11th of November, 1889, and 1 week later, Ferry was officially sworn in as governor. Ferry and the other recently elected officials and legislators wasted no time in getting to work, quickly approving the spending for building state offices and institutions, making laws, and allocating cash. They did this at a time when the new state was experiencing a significant growth surge as well as an economic boom. the population of Washington was getting close to 350,000, which was roughly 5 times what it was just a decade prior. A significant portion of this expansion occurred in metropolitan areas, with Seattle, Tacoma, and Spokane, the state's top 3 cities, accounting for approximately 1/3 of the entire population. The fast construction of rail lines, including a direct connection to Puget Sound across the Cascades via Stampede Pass, poured many more arrivals into western Washington and contributed to the rise of Seattle and Tacoma in particular. This was a key factor in the region's population explosion. In 1889, more miles of rail line were constructed in the state of Washington than in any other state, and for the following 2 years, Washington stayed in the top 3 states for this metric. The construction of railroads attracted not only settlers but also investors from the East Coast and even Europe, who poured money into Washington to finance the construction of further railroads and other forms of development. It should come as no surprise that huge firms and the investors in those corporations had a significant amount of influence on the government. As a result, the laws that were enacted tended to be business-friendly, which helped keep investment flowing in. During the first session of the state legislature, which lasted from November of 1889 until March of 1890, the state legislature itself was responsible for a significant amount of spending. In spite of the fact that Ferry and others had advocated for a reduction in spending, the first state legislature allotted close to $1 million, which was nearly double the amount that the previous territorial assembly had spent. The majority of it was allocated to normal schools for the purpose of training teachers in Bellingham, Ellensburg, and Cheney, as well as the School of Agriculture and Science in Pullman, which are now respectively the Universities of Western Washington, Central Washington, and Eastern Washington, as well as Washington State University. Ferry gave his approval to these new colleges despite his reservations about the amount of money being spent. The legislature was also responsible for the creation of a large number of additional state institutions, such as a land commission, commissioners of labor and insurance, boards that regulated medical professionals, dentists, and pharmacists, and a state military department. In June of 1890, a recently formed National Guard regiment conducted its first encampment in the vicinity of American Lake in Pierce County. At the time, the location was known as Camp Ferry, and it was named in honor of the governor. The location, which was subsequently given the name Camp Murray, was designated as the headquarters of the Washington National Guard and continues to serve in that capacity today. A considerably larger base for the United States Army was created, and it is now known as Joint Base Lewis-McChord. Despite what they had previously done, the legislature recessed in March of 1890 without drawing up any new legislative districts in preparation for the election that would take place in November of 1890. As a direct consequence of this, Governor Ferry summoned a special session in September with the sole purpose of redistricting the legislative districts, which was successful. During the majority of the second and final regular legislative session of his term, which took place in the beginning of 1891, Ferry was absent. As his health continued to deteriorate, he decided to seek treatment in the warmer climate of California, putting Lieutenant Governor Charles Lofton in charge of running the state in his absence. Legislators attempted to regulate transcontinental railroads, whose monopoly allowed them to charge farmers expensive prices, by mandating that rates for grain shipments be decreased by 15%. However, Acting Governor Lofton rejected the proposal. This was an unusual move to regulate transcontinental railroads at the time. When Ferry returned to the Evergreen State, he was asked to call a special session so that the legislature could override Lofton's veto. However, the railways, anxious about what additional rules legislators could pass, dropped grain rates themselves, and there was no need for a session to be held. There was no discernible improvement in Ferry's health. After deciding not to run for re-election in 1892, he handed the governorship over to fellow Republican John H. McGraw. He took his family and relocated to Seattle, where he would spend the remaining years of his life. On the 14th of October, 1895, Elisha Ferry passed away at the age of 70. Ferry County, which had just been established that year, was given his name by the legislature in his memory. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star review and don't forget to subscribe so that you never miss a new episode. Doing so really helps the show to grow and to expand to a new audience, so any help that you can give in that regard will be greatly appreciated. Thank you for listening to episode 143, Territorial and State Governor Elisha P. Ferry. Episode 144 will be released next week. A special thank you goes out to Alan Hirsch for providing the music for the podcast. If you have any questions about the show, please contact historyoftheevergreenstatepod@gmail.com. Thank you once again for listening to another episode of the History of the Evergreen State podcast. And until next week, I'm your host and producer, John C.
There's peace on the Skokomish, on the Queets, and on the Hull. There's calm on the Nisqually, born of ageless ice and snow. A land that nature loves so much, she stays the whole year round. I trade a royal palace for a shack on Puget Sound. There's Chimicum and Stillicum, where spouts the gooey duck. The singing Stillaguamish and the swirling Skookumchuck. And Moclips and Copalis, where the razor clams abound. A little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound. A little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound.